This is Dr. Sherry Siegel, co-hosting with Armand DeMille on The Positive Mind. Armand will be with us in just a few minutes. Today we're talking about a parent's responsibility to protect their child. This came to mind when I heard about a woman in South Carolina who was charged with criminal neglect because her son's weight. At age 14, he weighed over 550 pounds. And in Britain, a woman almost lost custody of her 8-year-old son. He weighed about 200 pounds. The Atlanta Journal, and that's a British magazine, a health official said that child abuse is not just about hitting your children or sexually abusing them. It's also about neglect. And in the United States, courts have expanded their legal definition of medical neglect to include morbid obesity and ruled that children were victims of neglect, the report said. So today, we're speaking with Armand and another guest, Molly Carmel, an MSW from the Wilkins Center in Greenwich. Molly, welcome to The Positive Mind.
Hi.
Oh, hi. Hi, Sherry. Here I am.
Hi, Armand.
I just made it. Good. Thank you very much, my friend. And hi there, Molly.
Hi.
Molly, I'm hearing your voice just a little muted. Could you speak up a little louder, please?
How's that?
That's much better. Thank you. Molly Carmel, who works at the Wilkins Center, and it kind of brings the issue to mind, this whole idea of a parent's responsibility when it comes to a child and different things that children do. And one of the reasons why Sherry picked you, Molly, is she thought you could at least talk to the fact that children suffer with overweight, and they suffer with it, and the parents don't know what to do. Now, the other day I was passing by a store where I heard a mother yelling at a child because she was eating an olive. And she said, you know how much fat there is in that olive? And this is an emaciated child. A child, not emaciated, she was very thin. And the mother was obsessed about the child's weight to the point where the child was afraid to eat an olive. Mm-hmm. Is that abuse? But on the other hand, if the kid ate 10 olives and the mother was serving him pizza at the same time, is that abuse? So I'm going to kind of drop this on you for a minute because I know you're a weight specialist. Not a weight specialist, but you're an
eating disorder specialist.
What do you think?
I'm not sure that either one of those are really definitional child abuse per se. I think that it's maybe not nice or not effective.
Well, here they're bringing criminal charges for neglect.
Well, I think that they're bringing those criminal charges, more specifically about the case that we're speaking about. I think that they're bringing those criminal charges up as a result of the child weighing 555 pounds, which makes him super morbid obese, which is sort of in the not a lot of people in this world that weigh that much, right?
Okay, so if he had weighed only 380 pounds, mm-hmm. then it would be okay.
Oh, I don't think I'm saying that by any means.
So at what point is there a crossover where the parent has a responsibility to ring the alarm bell?
I'm not sure that parents even know what the alarm bell is.
Right.
And I think that obesity is a very complicated issue, and it's a lot more complicated than maybe how we think about traditional child abuse, neglect and not giving your children clothes or meals or physical or even emotional abuse. That's also because obesity is a disease, and so it's rooted in biology primarily. And then I think it's also rooted for some people has some psychological parts to it, and then for all of us has some sociological parts to it. In fact, Kelly Brownell, the main researcher at Yale, the Rudd Center, you know, he calls our world obesogenic, meaning that it's sort of easier to be overweight than it is to be at a normal weight in our world. So I think when we're putting a big word like abuse on something that's far more complicated than what a traditional definition of abuse would be.
And yet these charges that are being brought against the parents and other charges that children are bringing against their own parents now. I mean, you know, it's highly likely that if a child weighed 300 pounds that she could sue her parents. And that case would make it to court.
A lot of cases make it to court.
yes, but that doesn't make light of it because the parents are now terrified. The parents are afraid of their children. So the power that parents would have in trying to guide a child is very limited by anything that might be meted out as a possible punishment, which could be considered abuse.
And Armand, before the show, you and I were talking, a parent walks a very fine line. On one side of the coin, the parent is saying, let me control your eating. And on the other extreme, a parent does not attend to helping a child with their food at all. So either way, they could be construed as neglecting their child's health.
Well, so, Mommy, yes.
But Armand, I hear you saying something that I take issue with, and that's saying that, you know, that these children need to be punished for being overweight. And
no, I didn't say that.
But I don't think that anybody in any way gets better or healthier by, you know, sort of having it beat into them. And I think that generally, even being a food police officer has never proven to be an effective way to get anybody, most specifically children, you know, to lose or gain weight, right? I mean, any child can access a dollar, which means that they can go buy 3 candy bars, which means that that's not a really good use of anyone's time, is to be policing food.
But Molly, with your agency, if somebody was concerned with their child and they couldn't do anything, they would do something called an intervention.
Absolutely.
And in this intervention, you treat this child as if the child has an addiction, which the child probably does have with the food, and you are forcing that child to enter a program. So we say no punishment, but to the child's point of view, hey, wait a minute, you're taking away my food and you're sending me to jail. So to the child's perception, it's punishment.
I don't think that that's necessarily the way that I think that that's one way, with substance abuse, right? That's one way that people get into treatment is by intervention, but the interventions aren't usually seen as punishment all of the time. I also think that with something like obesity, you know, it's a very interesting issue because there's some people who certainly have some of the psychological conditions that sort of we associate with addiction with regards to food, and then there's some people that don't. It's a very multifaceted issue in this way.
And just on your side, a child who is obese does feel enough shame that they could perceive the parent is really trying to help them because they feel powerless with their own weight too, because they're usually being shamed by all of their friends and everything. So I don't think that they would definitely see it as punishment.
Well,
I'm just saying.
Exactly. And I think that there's also one, you know, there's this really interesting study that asked kids if they would rather be overweight or not have a limb, or rather have cancer or be overweight. And every time they picked, you know, the not overweight category. I mean, I think that being, you know, overweight, you know, and there's also other studies that really support that overweight children are three or five times more likely to be overweight adults. And the childhood obesity, you know, is really linked to not graduating high school, not going to college, not getting married. And there's some really long-term social implications of overweight. But the solution isn't necessarily even an intervention. In the intervention similar to substance use, I mean, largely, you know, there really isn't anywhere to send kids when they're that overweight. It isn't like there are drug treatment centers for obesity all over. There's only actually one inpatient program that I know of that really could take care of a child who is overweight, and it's enormously expensive.
But to go back, I mean, part of what you're saying is we have this kind of twiggy psychology now where the whole world is looking as fat as an enemy, and maybe what we've got to do is instead of seeing fat as the enemy, even though it could be a physical challenge, there are certainly cultures where, you know, somebody who's 40 pounds overweight is normal. So maybe what we've got to do is work on the perception of fat being the enemy so that we don't have as much shame behind it as well. As well as I want to acknowledge that it is a problem. Part of the problem also is the insanity that we have about body weight.
Well, see, I think they're talking about two separate things, though, Armand.
I do, too.
Because the very basis of obesity is this, right? For an overweight person, if you cut off an overweight person's body and you cut off their head, right, and you talk to their body and you ask their body if it wanted to lose weight, the body would say no. There's really solid factual evidence biologically that that the body doesn't want to lose weight. So that's like a really big issue, right? Mm. And like I get all, and believe you me, I'm a therapist. I buy into it, a lot of this shame and stuff. But at the very base of this, we have a disease, and the same. There's information that people need to have about how to lose weight. That's very hard. And it takes usually takes some kind of behavioral intervention mm-hmm. to gain the skills that are needed for long-term weight control. And sort of that's what I do at Greenlight is this, that's what we do here is we teach people how to become weight controllers. It's not an innate thing. It's like running a 4-minute mile. There's nothing normal about being able to do that, right? But here we have people running marathons with 4-minute miles. You can train yourself to sort of go against what your biology wants you to do. But to say that that's abusive when people don't even have the knowledge, I don't think is a fair thing to say.
I agree with you. But, you know, if we look at the person who, what you say about overweight being a disease, I spoke to somebody who was in a medical corporation recently who was, you know, they were working on drugs for chemicals for trying to lose weight. And he said to me very clearly, he said, you know, none of these weight loss drugs are ever going to work because the thing that they have to do is control the apostat. And unless you could control that thing that tells you when you've had enough food, you're going to be fighting it for your entire life.
Right. Right.
Now,
so
that's where
it's an issue
the disease
of management. It's not an issue of solution.
Right. So what we're talking, what we're saying, therefore, is you're doomed for the rest of your life. You got to be on weight management. It's like an alcoholic who is always an alcoholic.
I mean, I think that there's one way to look at it is doomed. Another way to look at it is empowered. I mean, I think there's two ways to look at it. It could be a death sentence or a life sentence, right?
Right. The reversal of it. But what we're basically saying is overweight children are going to have a life of controlling. Maybe it'll change. Maybe it'll shift, you know? And so now we have to deal with that, both that. Now, what about on the other side of it? What about underweight? I don't know. Do you treat underweight children?
No. That's not my specialty in any way.
But does your institution treat?
Absolutely. Wilkins Center treats the spectrum of weight issues and eating disorders. Absolutely.
So do you see on the other side of it, since you're a specialist in this, do you see?
Well, I'm a weight management specialist. I specialize in obesity, weight management, binge eating, and non-restrictive bulimia.
And non-restrictive bulimia, what's the difference between
that? It means that you eat and then you throw up. Don't eat and then throw up, to make it as gross as I probably can on the phone.
I understand. But, you know, part of what's so difficult about it is it's hard to talk about any of this, you know. It's hard to talk about any of it because I believe when you get to the psychological factor of what happens with children, and here's where we have the question of the parent's responsibility. Does food, let's say that almost everybody who gets grossly overweight as a child, not grossly, but bigly overweight as a child, let's say 30% more than their normal weight, should be. But if they go to that point, there's a couple of things not working in their lives. One is maybe their chemistry is not working properly. We can go with that and agree with that. And then secondarily,
but Armand, that's not probably. That's definitely. There's definitely a biologic. That's a really important thing that none of us really talk about enough. It's not probably. Definitely, there's a biological component. It comes before any of this hoarding. It comes before anything.
You think whether a child is loved or not loved, if he's meant to be fat, he's going to be fat. And that all the non-love in the world is not going to induce somebody to overeat.
No, that's not what I think at all. I think that there are things that can exacerbate biology. And so neglect can certainly exacerbate biology, but the biology is primary.
So the biology is there, and maybe more of us have this biological flaw than we know.
Oh, yeah.
And that the society has worked so hard. You know, I always thought that the reason behind cigarette addiction was that cigarette addiction was one of the ways of dealing with that very physical, that very flaw, the apostat not being able to control your eating, that a cigarette substituted for it, because most people, when they stop smoking, immediately gain weight. So I thought that the addiction itself of cigarettes was not so much to the cigarette, but to what it controlled in people as well. Do you find that people who are overweight have multi-addictions or many more than just one, or any compulsive behaviors besides just the overweight? Do they tend to be more compulsive in general?
I think there are some overweight people have some more addictive or compulsive parts to them. So I think that people who are overweight with disordered eating certainly have that. And, you know, again, it's because addiction isn't solution focused, it's management focused. And so a lot of what the focus has to be on is sort of learning how to use those skills of compulsion, sort of, for lack of a better phrase, you know, for good instead of evil. You know, it's sort of like a lot of the people that we treat at Greenlight, you know, are very highly successful, motivated people. They're very successful in their jobs. And a lot of the reason that they're so successful is because they're compulsive and, you know, sort of high anxiety, high motivation. And it's learning how to refocus some of your behaviors and thoughts around eating to work for you instead of against you.
Our guest is Molly Carmel, who is the director of Greenlight at Wilkins Center, which is a place that focuses on weight management for adolescents and adults. Now, when you say adolescents and adults, you don't treat children?
We treat children starting at 11. But usually if there's anything younger than 11, it's largely a parental issue. We try to work with the parents first before we get the kid in, because there's not a lot of brain work that can be done at those younger ages. And a lot of the time the environment really needs to be changed and the information needs to be going through the parent to the kid. And so we would treat a whole family before we treat an individual 9-year-old, because a 9-year-old can't do much.
What got you into this part of this profession, Molly?
I've always had an extraordinary interest in the field of obesity. I myself am a long-term weight controller. I've lost and maintained 175 pounds for nearly 10 years. And I have just, like, I just think that it is a completely untapped solution-focused place. I don't think we've found what works yet. And, you know, I have a thirst and a desire to help people feel better. So about 6 years ago, I was recruited to start the first ever therapeutic boarding school in California called Wellspring Academies. And I think that I've been doing it ever since. You know, it's just my love of my life, essentially.
Molly, tell me about brain chemistry. As I understand it, there are two chemicals, leptin and ghrelin.
Yeah.
Do we know anything about to tap into how these things affect our brains and eating?
The research at this point is so unclear on both of those. And I do think it is exactly what Armand was saying before. I mean, I think that there, even when the data does come out on it, I think that there are still the solutions to it are going to be so behavioral that, you know, sort of we need to stop focusing on this magic cure and this cortisol, leptin. I mean, I think that, you know, let's just say we do find the magic pill. We still have years before that happens and years before. And there's some really small behavioral changes that people can make and some real information that people can get. I mean, I think that it is very seductive to talk about the addiction portion of this. And it's very, am I loved? Am I not loved? And at the very end of the day, I think that that sometimes prevents us from actually doing some of the actions that it takes to be a long-term weight controller. I think we can get very caught up in a lot of this. Does my mom love me? Did my mom hide food from me? And there's some real solid behaviors. And what needs to happen with obesity, too, is within the form of education and starting to learn about, you know, your biology and the way to work with it instead of against it is a lot of ownership and you know, learning how to eat the foods that are going to not kill you, and learning how to move your body and learning how to take ownership and take a lot of this shame. I mean, I think there's some innate shame in being overweight, right? If it's essentially based on the studies I just told you that people would rather have cancer than be overweight. But in order to, sometimes the antidote to shame is power. Right, the power really is in learning on how to solve this and how to manage it.
But going back to Sherry's question, which is, what do we know let's not just ignore it, because most of what our audience always hears is about behavioral control, about diet. We have more diet programs on WBAI on our program than probably anywhere else. We have nutritional experts. We have a lot of that. We're talking about that all the time. What people don't know about is some of the physical factors. So when I talk about an apostat, you want to talk about that a little? Or maybe, Sherry, you want to inform the audience about it? Because most of the audience never heard about it. For example, the recent drug that came out from Europe, the one that was banned because people were getting depressed and killing themselves, do you know which one I'm talking about? It was scheduled to come out in America. It's very popular in Europe.
Started with a cannabinoid?
Acomplia, right. Mm-hmm. It worked on the cannabinoid receptor, which was such an interesting thing, because when you think about it, the cannabinoid receptor, which is the receptor that receives marijuana, in effect, is the very thing that makes people pig out, and they eat a lot whenever you smoke marijuana, because it goes to this cannabinoid receptor that this drug, Acomplia, when it came out on the market, worked on muting that receptor, and therefore it made people lose their appetites. Because they felt satiated. That was the whole concept. And it worked for many, many years. And then I believe some drug companies in America found out it was competitive, and they wound up bombing it by saying people committed suicide when they took it, which I don't think was really true. But the item here was, wait, look at our chemistry. Cannabinoid receptors may be responsible for our propensity for gaining weight, some of us, whereas the rest of us may not have this problem. What are the balances? What do we know about the chemistry of it? We know that if you are active and you exercise, you have a tendency not to accumulate as much fat as if you don't exercise. That we know. What else do we know chemically and physically about the science of weight gain and weight loss? Could either of you two answer that for me?
Sure. Do you want to go? I mean, I'll go second.
Well, you go. Go. No, you go first.
Well, I mean,
you're our guest. We treat our guests very well.
That's so kind. That is so
and
kind.
By the way, I really thank last minute you're putting your schedule aside and coming on air with us, and I'm so grateful, and you're so well spoken. I'm so glad you're a representative.
You.
I mean,
you can call my mom after.
Yeah, well, she can listen to the show. She can listen to the program by going to our website and just digging into our archives. In fact, this program will always be available for the rest of eternity. It'll go into a little space capsule, and people could hear it forever.
Oh, that's so lovely.
You could put it on your website if you want. You really could.
Oh, okay, well, there you go. That's fun.
Okay.
Well, here's sort of what my, you know, I think that there's a sociological and biological part of it that, you know, it's written about pretty extensively. And that's that, you know, I don't think that our bodies have much idea that they're living in 2009, right? And I think that my body specifically, you know, thinks it lives in about 1009, and it doesn't really understand, you know, in 1009, there's certainly, I wasn't going to the tree and getting Cheetos off of the tree, and, you know, I wasn't sitting and talking on the phone on an interview on the radio. I was, you know, farming. And I think what's interesting, though, about the farming specifically, and the way that we, and so essentially, right, I, as a weight controller, you know, someone who minds my weight, you know, I have what's called like pretty, in 2009, pretty bad metabolism, right? However, you know, if I was stranded on a desert island with one of my friends who sort of gets to eat whatever they want, you know, I would outlive her without question. So I actually have a very efficient metabolism.
So
living in a
very,
world
you have
right.
a slow metabolism as compared to most people. You see yourself as 1,080. I see myself as kind of a BC kind of guy.
Oh, me too. Oh, wow. We would have a lovely time together, you know.
So especially if we cook dinner.
Yeah,
right.
Didn't get to eat much of it.
Okay, so you're saying metabolism can be, for some people, very, very slow, and for other people, it's speedy. Is that what you're saying?
Well, and the other thing I think is interesting within the concept of this, what's called the hunter-gatherer theory, is this hypothesis called the 50-gene hypothesis, which sort of says that, you know, that when there's times of abundance, that our genes are sort of made, because our genes are made to survive famine, okay, that during times of abundance, our genes are looking to sort of hoard food. And that's not, you know, that doesn't make me a bad person. that makes my genes not know that it's 2009. There's two very separate issues there, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, it's like wearing a size 50 jeans is what I always thought it was when you have the 50 gene hypothesis. But yes, yes.
But no, with a constant abundance of food, okay,
sure.
My genes, so when I'm eating a pretzel, my G-E-N-E-S, are saying, oh, this is fabulous, get me more, because, you know, there hasn't been a famine for as long as you've been alive. So my it's almost like my genes are positive that there's going to be a famine tomorrow. And so, you know, the reason I want more pretzels is not because I'm a bad person or because I'm a gluttonous person. It's really for a survival mechanism that doesn't necessarily apply.
Okay, so there's one. One is accumulation, because polar bears, you know, they're fat. I mean, you get an average polar bear at the end of a season, he's a chunky guy, you know what I mean? But because he's doing just that, he's laying down the stores, the reserves, and we all have this tendency. Some of us have this tendency to do it more than others. Some of us, we're going to be the ones who are going to survive the famine, and the others of us are going to go out there and be hunting and replenishing our food because we're going to be the hunters as opposed to... I mean, you know, when you think about weight as a gathering thing, it is kind of gathering.
Well, you think, at the gatherer, I think they're saying it with regards to, like, berries, frankly.
I know, but it's kind of the way your fat gathers on your body a little bit, too.
Yes, that's true. But, I mean, so I think that, I mean, I really do think that a lot of this is not, I mean, I think that there are, like, I'm not disagreeing with you.
And there
is this obsessive, compulsive, addictive-ish, you know, part of it, but I think at the very root of it is this really, it's sort of like this maladaptive biology that's going on in a real obesogenic society. I think that that's the center of a lot of this issue.
And Molly, so we live essentially in a society that is constantly abundant, and especially in New York City, abundance abounds.
And flooded with information about where it's available, right? If you want it, just reach out your hand.
And advertising that promotes ways to get it inexpensive ways.
And you gotta have it.
Gotta have it. Especially, and I imagine that children are prone to being subjects or targets for a lot of the advertising.
Okay,
without question. And I think that there's some study, and I'm going to totally butcher it, but there's some study that says that you could talk to your children for 10 minutes every single day about healthy eating habits and vegetables and fruit. And by the time they got to school, they would be exposed to more poor media than your talk could ever give them. I mean, this is a real challenge we have in front of us, and even appropriate media.
So, at the beginning, what we have are two things. We could say that there could be a different metabolism for different people, and that people with a slower metabolism might have a tendency to gain weight more than a person with a faster metabolism. We also can say that there are people who have genetic structures that may select for the accumulation of weight as opposed to those who don't select so. That's two factors so far. What else do we know chemically? What else do we know about the physical?
Well, there's another interesting hypothesis called the fat cell theory that sort of says that, you know, friends come and friends go, but fat cells are forever, which means that sort of a person who's genetically overweight is born with more fat cells than someone who isn't genetically overweight. But as you get fatter and fatter, your fat cells grow and grow and grow, and then they multiply. And, you know, so even if a 500-pound person ended up weighing 200 pounds, their fat cells, all the fat cells that they had in their body when they were 500 pounds still exist in their body at 200 pounds, and they have a desire to grow and grow and grow and grow and grow. They're like kind of like frat boys, I always like to think of them as. And so that's an issue, too, when you have these fat cells that are, you know, thirsty for fat usually.
Do you know who Lou Aronne is? Lou Aronne?
Yeah, of course. I was
talking to Lou about this once, and he said there is a body weight that most people return to, which is what their body is really built for. He said, if you wind up at 250 pounds over and over again, that's what your body's built for. That's where it wants to go. Everything we do, he said, is to try to get away from the biological imperative, which is be 250 pounds.
The set point theory.
Is
there truth to that?
Well, according to him, it is.
And I certainly would not. I would not battle him. It's not a good use of my time. And I think that we're all hypothesizing a lot of the time. I think the most important part of that, right? The basis of that is essentially that a lot of people who are 5 foot are not. Their bodies have no interest in being 100 pounds. So that is really where this knowledge is power comes in.
Well, we're going to have to take a short break. If you would stay with us, you're going to hear some commercials and you're going to hear some music, but do stay with us. Can you stay with us?
Oh, me?
Yes, you.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Well, hang on. We're going to be doing more. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, a little music about who's at fault, and then we'll come back with our discussion.
We're tuned to Hi-Fi, WBAI 99.5 on your FM dial. New York.
Pencil. Okay, this is Joe Franklin broadcasting on radio station WBAI.
It's 99.5% all natural and preservative free. WBAI FM in New York.
I love this radio station.
On WBAI 99.5 FM, the Caldwell Chronicle is on the air. I'm Earl Caldwell. Tune in for our broadcast every Friday, 3 to 5 p.m., right here on listener-supported Pacifica Radio in New York City.
Who is to blame by Songster? This is Armand DeMille, Dr. Sherry Siegel, Molly Carmel, and a special guest just walked into our studio today. Hey, Philippe. Welcome here. Hold on a second. Say hello to our audience.
Hello, everyone.
Hey, tell them how you wind up being here.
The whole story?
Yeah, you'll give me a short story.
Okay. I came here to see Dr. Armand because I'm doing therapy with him, and it's really nice. It's a good experience.
And so you got here through somebody who knew the radio program, right? Or you listened to the radio program?
My mom has been listening to the radio program since I was born.
Since he was born. So get this in mind. For his entire life, he's been hearing me in the speakers at his home. So now he's here talking on the very radio that goes into the speakers that his mother is listening to. Philippe, that's kind of amazing, don't you think?
It's a modern miracle.
It's how's that for cool? All right, and we're going back. We have Molly Carmel with us as well. And we're talking today about the parent's responsibility. You see, like, not everybody's got a parent like Philippe's parent who says, you know, okay, look, Philippe, I know things aren't going too well for you. Let's get you some help. Most people don't have that, or many people don't have that. And when they run into troubles, when they run into problems, what are they to do? So let me toss it back to you, Molly. We were talking about some of the physical elements about weight gain and weight maintenance. physical thing. Do you think, Sherry, do you think that certain people can eat certain foods and not other foods? Do you think there's a person who can't afford to eat sugar and another person who can't afford to eat fat and another person who can't afford to eat celery? I mean, do you think that there are those chemical distinctions in people?
As we were talking about before the break, it's clear that some people's metabolism seems to be on fast, on high grade, and can eat a lot of food and not gain weight. Many of these same people are also very active, so it's calories in and calories out for some people. Very active people can also eat a lot of calories because they're putting out a lot of calories.
What is the apostat?
I think of the apostat as the place in our brain, hypothalamus, that controls our desires. And some of our desires are to be satisfied.
Do you think there's an apostat specifically for food? Or do you think when the apostat goes wild, you can't be satisfied with anything? I think there are specific ones for different things. What do you think?
I think that's where our environment comes in, and where, as children, we learn to find comfort in some things and maybe not so much in others. And as our bodies change, as we mature in age, sometimes those comfort foods become comfort substances. So sometimes they cross over, and there are studies that show that some people with addiction have the ability to cross over into other substances. But certainly I can remember Eric Clapton talking about his first addiction being food and candy.
So the apostat is really the thing that controls gluttony. You know, what we used to think of as gluttony, which was a heavy judgment that we would put on people who were just insatiable, right, was really, we're saying, hey, we're finding a reason why you were this way.
Isn't that one of the seven deadly sins, gluttony?
Yeah.
And you're right. So we clearly judged it as a society, and even religion judged that propensity.
Sherry, you said something about two chemicals. Presence of one means you're going to eat a lot. Presence of the other one means you're going to be satiated. What are the two chemicals?
Well, they're called ghrelin and leptin.
Where do they come from?
And as I understand it, ghrelin is the substance that signals our body to feel more hungry, to look for food, possibly increases our cravings, and leptin is the opposite, helps us feel satiated. And Molly, you probably know some more about the research of those two substances, do you?
I just think at this point the research is so unclear on it, I feel like so many people are really waiting for, especially the leptin research, to come out. The real guaranteed research on leptin to come out at this point. I don't really even feel all that comfortable talking about it because I just think it's, you know, my ear is on that everybody's sort of saying, well, it's about to happen and it's about to happen. But I feel like it's sort of been about to happen for at least 10 years.
And certainly in the meantime.
What are we going to do until then, right?
Exactly. We don't want to wait and say, well, we're going to continue in the way we're going until we have those drugs or those substances that can counteract the ones in our bodies. But we certainly have behavioral methods, cognitive behavioral therapy.
Yeah, and well, listen, I mean, the other thing is, I remember, you know, there's a drug called Antabuse for alcoholism. I mean, right? And
right. Our audience might not know what that is, but
well,
Antabuse.
There's a drug that you can take every day that if you drink alcohol and are on Antabuse, you will get very, very sick.
It makes you rich.
Yes, and in fact, you know, any good alcoholic that I know who's on Antabuse has certainly tried to drink while they were on it and sort of burned their hand that way. And I think sort of that same thing applies to things like gastric bypass surgery, which is a very successful method of, you know, treating obesity, and yet still has about only a one-third success rate. So
and has this other interesting component that we've discovered recently, which is that a majority of the people who have had gastric bypass have turned to alcohol.
Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting. So this alcoholism emerges And I was sitting at a table with somebody who had gastric bypass the other day, and she was drinking like a fish, and she said to me, I've just got to have pure vodka, she said, because that's taken the place of everything else. I can no longer eat sugar. I can no longer eat fat. My body won't let me, but I could drink alcohol.
Wow.
So like, you know, what are we thinking when we try to shape the body that way? The
well,
only
I'm sorry, I guess I'm not trying to in any way demean or make it less important, the research that we're doing on leptin. I think it's really important, and I think that when it comes out, it's going to be fantastic. But I still think that there's going to be some pretty serious obesity no matter what.
You're absolutely right. And for many of us who have looked at the studies or experienced weight loss programs, we've known that through the years, there has always been a magic bullet that comes out every few years.
That's right.
So you're absolutely right. And I think I want to go back to the beginning of the show where we talked about a parent's responsibility, because I think it's especially difficult, you know, with adults, we're dealing with their own desire to change their eating and to potentially change their body, and their health. But with children, especially adolescents who are kind of in between being children and adults, that's a real challenging time. Can you help? Can you give our parents some insight?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think the other thing that you bring up such a brilliant point. I mean, like adolescence is really hard no matter what. So it's certainly again being exacerbated with some of this obesity stuff. And I think the first point that I think is really important is what I said before and the two things I said before, which I'm more than happy to repeat, which is, first of all, I really don't think that people get better, you know, being shamed or being, you know, getting the crap beat out of them, right? I don't think that, you know, scared straight works very well, and it certainly doesn't work well, in my opinion, with weight or weight management. I think that sort of we do that enough to ourselves that doesn't need to be the treatment method. The second thing I think is really important for parents to remember is that really access to 50 cents a dollar is not a very hard thing for a kid to get to, and then they can sneak themselves, you know, 1 to 5 candy bars or, you know, Cheeto bags. And so, again, going at this very punitive, policing sort of place is not going to be the best place to go. And sort of at Greenlight, we talk about having parents be consultants instead of police people. In fact, we encourage them to sort of like hand over their badges, because of this policing isn't going to work. And it's usually just going to foster even worse relations between parents and kids and food, parents and food, you know, fill in the blank, wherever you want.
So what is necessary? Let me tell you something I believe about AA. I'm going to talk about Alcoholics Anonymous for a minute.
Mm-hmm. I love AA, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a great organization.
I think part of the magic of the organization, and this is my belief, is that people who have addictions are very often trying to replace a family that they didn't have in the form of finding some kind of internal safety through their addiction being satisfied with either drugs, alcohol, or compulsive behaviors. I believe the reason that AA works is because it replaces your family. It gives you a gathering of accepting people, people who get together and they say, we are a family, we're all in this together. And I think that's part of the magic of it, that people can actually say, all right. You know, in all of the 12-step programs, you got the same theme. We're together on this. We can work on this.
Yeah,
so,
I think that's very true. I think it sort of makes it less my problem and makes it the problem, right? And so it doesn't personalize or pathologize the problem as much.
But one of the things I'm kind of getting to is that somewhere in your work with people, and I can tell by just talking to you, you not only offer guidelines, Molly, you also offer love to the people you work with. And I know you may
laugh about it, darling Armand.
But no, I want you to talk about it. Talk about the love that you feel for the people who you're working with.
Listen, I think this is hard, you know, and I think the solution...
Hard for you to talk about? Or,
No. It's not, believe me, I don't think it's anything's hard for me to talk about, but... You know, I think that obesity and weight management is hard. I think it's hard because it's a triple-tiered problem. I think it's biological, and I think it's psychological, and I think it's sociological. And so,
So what about your love? Let me ask you about that.
The love, you know, I think that the love is in the understanding. Is in the. I think that, yeah, I do think that green light, we have this sort of like, listen, this is
all
hard.
Right, now, wait a minute. Molly?
Yes?
I'm going to back you up.
I'm ready.
I'm talking about your love, not green light's love. I know it makes you nervous to talk about it, but there is something inside you that is very tender that goes along with your structure. Because
is this a billable hour, Armand? This is wonderful.
If you had a person who came along, if you trained people in doing this stuff.
Which I do, yeah.
Yeah, but they're not going to do it as well because they're not you.
Okay.
So there is something about your heart, and I want you to talk to me about that. I want you to tell me when I sit with a person, like when I sit with Philippe.
Right.
Right? I mean, my heart just opens wide open, and he kind of says to me, oh, all right, here's a guy who really cares about me.
Yeah.
Because I really do.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You have that, and you could convey that to a person who you're trying to help control their very source of nurturance, food itself.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's true. I mean, I think that, you know, I think we're all more the same than we are different. And I think that sometimes with regards to the therapeutic process that people just want to be heard, and they want to be heard in a non-judgmental, understanding sort of way. And I think that I commit myself to that with regards to my, you know, to my training and to my profession. I think that that's, sometimes people just need to be heard and have me not, you know, like open my eyes or slip my wrist when they tell me what they perceive as the most horrible thing they've ever heard. That
so,
it's
Molly,
like, okay.
Molly.
Yes, sir.
You love your people?
I do. I'm a lucky girl. I love my job.
No, not your job. The people.
Yeah, I love all people.
And the people who you work with, you love.
Yeah, I believe in that Buddhist idea that nobody causes pain who isn't in pain. I really believe in that.
Yeah, I hear.
I think you said something important, too, that you accept them without judgment.
Yeah.
I think that's a big, big portion of helping someone who suffers from any type of addiction.
I think so. And I think we have, you know, we all sort of have this saying around here that we're like, listen, we've seen worse, we've done worse. You know, it's like, calm down. It's not sort of a judgment-free zone. And it's the only way that work's ever going to get done is if you do it in a real non-judgmental way and sort of understand that, you know, we're fallible and this is hard. And I think that that's, you know, when you're treating obesity and weight management, I think that that's sort of where we start. You know, we start on this premise. It's like, it's not if you're going to mess up your diet, you're going to mess up your diet. You know, weight management is not abstinence-based the way that alcohol is. You can just stop drinking. You can't stop eating. And so the process has to be a little bit more forgiving in that way.
Now, Molly, there must have been cases, as you know, have you been able to tell by now, I'm very concerned with the human element of our programming. It's not just about facts.
Yeah, I got that.
There are people I've seen where I failed. I just couldn't get to them. I didn't have the tools, or they were touching something in me that made me not respond, and I felt like a complete, oh, man, I just don't know how to get to this person. And it was my shortcoming, not the person's inability to be reached. Mm-hmm. I know that if I had somehow I wasn't being efficient, and I take full responsibility for that. And there are people that you've seen that you can't help. Is there a specific kind of category that you've seen that says this person is going to be not responsive to my kind of treatment?
Well, I think I want to say something before that, which is I don't think that people necessarily use the help that they receive in the time that we as clinicians want them to.
Okay.
Right. So, I think working in adolescent treatment for as long as I have, you know, that's something I've had to sign on to, that just because the behaviors don't indicate that an adolescent has listened, right? It doesn't mean that they haven't listened, and it doesn't mean that in 2 months, 2 years, 20 years, that they're not going to say, oh, God, remember when I was in that clinic with that girl, Molly Carmel, and she said this thing, oh, you know, maybe that was a good idea. And so I don't necessarily think that. That's why I think that, you know, therapeutic outcomes are hard to measure in a lot of ways.
So you have a way of telling yourself if somebody leaves your program without progress, Molly says, well, they'll get it later on.
Molly says that. I think Molly also says the door's always opened.
And does Molly ever say, I failed?
I just don't believe in failure as a concept.
Huh. You don't think that there's ever a case where you can't get to it, you can't work, you made a mistake?
Well, I mean, I think we're all fallible, Armand. But
No, that's what I'm asking.
Is it progress, not perfection?
Yes, thank you. That's right. I mean, I just don't think, I don't believe in the word failure. I think we fail when we die. And I think people have their own process.
Okay, I believe in the word because I don't put a judgment on it. You know, have failed means maybe for me to acknowledge my limitations.
Well, listen, I think I have limitations. I think we all have limitations. But I think that, you know, I really believe in, like, the Di Clemente stages of change. And so I believe that there's success if you've brought somebody from pre-contemplation to contemplation. I think that that's a successful intervention. I guess that my definition of...
Good point.
My definition of success is just different, especially when you're dealing with something with weight management. See, I think that if I can get somebody, I can help somebody to stop gaining weight, then I've been successful in an intervention, because that's a big deal in obesity. I'm not trying to get people necessarily to all be like size fours. That's this epidemic is much bigger than that.
Sure.
And so, Molly, just going back to our early question, is this issue an issue that a parent should be accused of, not of neglect?
Can you not load that so much with the word accused? That is this issue, right?
Right.
One where a parent should somehow take more responsibility in dealing with it. Do you think the parent should take a greater effort in working at helping these kids?
It's such a hard question.
It's such a hard question
because...
It's a conundrum, it really is.
It's a conundrum because parents don't get arrested when their kids drink too much. They get arrested when they serve their kids alcohol, right? So I also think that there is an enormous amount of misinformation out there for people in general to lose weight. I think there's a tremendous amount of misinformation for parents on how to help their kids lose weight. So I don't think that we have protocol available. And even for what it's worth, I don't necessarily even think that substance abuse has gotten the protocol down enough as well either. So I don't think that there's a proper protocol that parents can follow in order for this kind of culpability of the word abuse to be there in the way that maybe we're doing it right now.
And so
I also don't necessarily think that taking a kid out of the family system is going to be the way to solve or even teach the kid how to manage their weight, right?
You know, in a lot of the programs, Sherry was telling me, a lot of the school programs, they're taking away all the sugars and the sweets and the snacks. Mm-hmm. They're trying to remove them to bring some consciousness to it. When you work with a child, when you work with an adolescent around a weight issue, do you consult the whole family? Do you do family therapy?
We try to as much as possible because, you know, one of the number one I guess advice or wish list that we have with all of our patients here is that we ask them to sort of defat their home, sort of make their home into the safest place possible. Take all the high fat, calorically dense foods out of the home and replace it with, you know, not so calorically dense, still delicious, still, you know, yummy.
Well, give me an
food.
Example of that. I mean, you can't replace too many things with carrots because the carrots go bad.
You know, that is like, and by the way, right, like if weight management was as simple as eating broccoli instead of potato chips, I would most certainly be out of a job, you know.
Right.
But I think that even as much as it, like, food has screwed us up, there are helpful foods out there. So, I mean, that is taking the real potato chips out of the house and putting in baked ones or fat-free ones. I think that is taking, you know, full-fat ice cream out of the house and putting in, you know, fudgicles or, like, lower fat, and sort of usually, like, single-serving, you know, ice creams into the house. I think that that's having fresh fruit and cutting it up and making, I mean, for financially viable people, right, you know, having fresh fruit available and promoting it. I also think it's, you know, sitting down to meals as much as you can. I think that it's also sort of making, you know, it's weight management. One of the researchers said this is not my own independent thought. Weight management is not about willpower. It's about planning. And so having, you know, plans around, well, what do we do when we go to Wendy's? What do we eat? What's healthy? You know, doing some research around. As I was reading in this article about what we're talking about, is, you know, the mother saying, you know, we have to go to fast food. I have two jobs. And, you know, fast food is not all bad. And I think that you can make healthy out of fast food if you need to. And perfection being the enemy of good and something being better than nothing, I think that there's always a better option than a Big Mac, right? So even if you're against ordering just a grilled chicken sandwich, which is like what my wish would be for a client, there's still something better, right? They're not the best. There's something better than ordering a Big Mac and fries.
We're going to have to go, Molly. My guest is Molly Carmel, who could probably spend much more time with Sherry Siegel, Dr. Sherry Siegel. Molly is the director of Green Light, which is a program at the Wilkins Center in Connecticut. Isn't that right?
Yeah, we also have an office in Manhattan.
Office here in Manhattan. Absolutely. As well. Do you have a website?
We sure do. It's greenlightwc.com. So GreenLightWC.com.
And if you happen to look in that program, you'll get a photograph of Molly, who's not going to look anything like you think she looks. You know, you take a look. Molly, it's been a real pleasure to have you on air.
Likewise, Armand. Thank you.
Thank you, Molly.
Okay, bye-bye.
This is Armand DeMille here with The Positive Mind. My special thank to Molly and to you, Sherry, and Philippe for being with us today. That was a really cool thing for you to stop in here.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. We'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends. If you want to hear a copy of today's program, you can go to thepositivemind.com, www.thepositivemind.com, or to WBAI.org. Either one, my friends, you get the program. Look forward to being with you tomorrow.
WBAI has come a long way on our path to financial recovery. In order to keep that momentum going, we need for you to honor your pledge. The true measure of a fund drive is in the follow-through. So when you get that invoice in the mail, please respond. You can choose to send a check or money order, or you can convert your pledge to credit card or pay in installments by electronic funds transfer. Remember that your support is deeply needed and appreciated by this radio station and by the staff, volunteers, and listeners of WBAI 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
Doesn't this line ever move?
Someone can't decide which donut.
I just want my 7-grain bread, that's all.
The apple pie is on sale.
The apple pie is from yesterday.
I feel like I'm from yesterday.
What is so hard about picking a donut?
Well, some people don't make snap decisions.
Flip a coin.
Or take your time. I don't mind waiting my turn.
But this isn't just waiting.
It's waiting and waiting and waiting.
I know. That's why I'm sure glad I've got my WBAI.
Be glad you've got your WBAI. Become a member online at WBAI.org.
Excuse me, constable. Caught the West End murderer yet?
We'll catch him, don't you worry, sir.
That's the spirit.
All aboard for the Highlands!
Hi, this is Charles Edwards. I play Richard Hannay in the 39 Steps at the Court Theatre.
Hi, this is Jennifer Farron. I play three different characters in the 39 Steps.
I'm Cliff Saunders. I play Man 1.
And I'm Arnie Burton, and I play Man 2.
And you're tuned to
WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
99.5 FM, streaming on the web at WBAI.org.
Read all about it! Read all about it!
All aboard!
Play a promo. We're between shows.
Well, which one do you want?
Play anything. We don't want dead air.
Remember, WBAI's fall membership drive runs from October 14th through November 7th right here at 120 Wall Street, 10th floor. To become a volunteer to answer phones during the drive, call Vera in advance at 212-209-2826 so your name can be entered in the security computer. See you during the drive.
That's the promo you played?
I thought it was good.
Yeah, it was. And you can dance to it.
Yeah.
Just a couple of promos and announcements, getting you prepared for the upcoming fall fundraising drive here at WBAI. That's where you're tuned to, 99.5 FM. We are listener-sponsored and commercial-free. We are community radio. We want to thank you all for your participation in helping to rebuild radio station WBAI, bring us up from our knees, as I've heard the phrase coined. And that's actually pretty appropriate, pretty accurate. It's just about 2 p.m. in New York City, and it's 68 degrees, partly cloudy in New York City. Thanks to Jennifer Sindab for her intervention in behalf.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.